Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. So for those of you who haven't been on this retreat before, or not for a long time anyway, this is now the time when Lungpa Pasano turns over the afternoon sessions to several of the rest of us. So for the next few days, this slot gets filled by myself and Ajahn Yanako, Debbie, to give some reflections. And this is the third day of retreat. Third full day, anyway. And generally, oftentimes, a day that is kind of a transition day for some people, third, fourth days, as the mind starts to settle, still holding on to some of the activities of the days and weeks before coming here, but maybe starting to let go a little bit, but probably not as much as you want. And those of us coming from the monastery aren't really any exception to this experience. We've had a very engaged, active time leading up to this retreat. And just speaking for myself, I've been very engaged with a lot of monastery happenings. I was talking with one of the people who's on retreat here now, just at the on the first day as we were coming in on Friday, and he was saying that he'd been coming from working 12 to 15-hour work days, and it's pretty fried. I'm really looking forward to this, and I don't know if I've been working 12 to 15 hours a day, but it kind of feels like that sometimes. It's the experience, and you know, monastery's no exception to happenings in the world. You know, we have crazy neighbors and legal issues and personality conflicts and all sorts of different kinds of things happening at the monastery that you'd sometimes people think that a monastery should be free from those kinds of things. But lo and behold, we live in the world too and have to interact with all of these aspects. So they carry with them a momentum. You know, if that's what we engage in, that's what the experience of our mind is like. And it can't be expected to just come in, check in, settle into your room, come to the talk the first night and the next day just to, you know, plop into a nice state of samadhi. It doesn't work that way. And I suspect I'm not the only one experiencing that. But the mind has a momentum, and what we put into it is what we experience. So the way it is right now, what you're experiencing right now, is the way it should be. It may not be the way you want it to be, or the way I want it to be, but it's the way it has to be because of causes and conditions that have led to it. If it shouldn't be this way, it wouldn't be this way, is a way that I've heard that often phrased. So just accepting that there's a certain momentum that has a life of its own and it kind of needs to play itself out. But it's an important thing to remember that, as the Buddha says in one of his discourses, that what we think about and ponder on frequently, that becomes the inclination of our mind. So we are all experiencing that, and that whatever we've been thinking about putting into our minds, that's what the inclination of our mind has become, and that we're experiencing that right now. And to realize that that also means that we have some influence in how we can affect the experience of our mind by choosing what we pay attention to. And so this is an opportunity to try and purposefully remove ourselves from what we usually try and pay attention to, or what we usually do pay attention to, and try and pay attention to something else, something that's a little more conducive to peaceful mind states, to tranquility, to contentment. I think there's a tendency for many Western meditators to want to just come in and immediately focus on the breathing, find the breath, and use that as the way to become peaceful, the way to settle down. And sometimes for many people, that's quite difficult. It's very hard to just sit down and all of a sudden find the breath and sit with it and be with it and not get distracted. So there's, as Lungpa was talking about this morning, samatha, calming and tranquility of the mind, and investigation, the other part, vipassana, are developed together. And sometimes, in my mind, particularly inclines towards the investigative side of things. It doesn't immediately settle in the breathing all that easily right off the bat. And I find that some skillful investigation or some skillful reflection in a very active sense is a very useful thing to do as a significant part of my practice. I find that that actually helps settle my mind rather than trying to command my attention to the breathing process right off the bat. And if you're somebody who needs kind of backup from the suttas to allow you to do that, there are different ways that the suttas approach meditation practice. It's not all just tranquility first and then the, you know, development of insight, but different approaches. And even talking about, for some people, samatha precedes vipassana. For some, vipassana precedes samatha. For some, it's developed in tandem, that kind of thing. But also, one of the structures that the Buddha uses is the seven factors of enlightenment. And if you take, you know, you don't have to take that in a linear form either, although developing those seven factors, that I don't think the Buddha intended everything to be taken in a linear form, but there is a certain progression of those seven factors that can be reflected on in that kind of linear fashion. And if you do that with this, then you see this is one of those structures that actually begins with investigation and moves on towards tranquility as a result. And concentration. So the general sequence that it's presented in is always everything starts with mindfulness. So that's the first factor of the seven factors of enlightenment. So you have to be developing that sense of sati, bringing to mind a skillful approach, a skillful contemplation. That's where it starts. So you have to kind of know what you're doing, what you're moving towards and what you're picking up, remembering to stay with a theme that's going to move you in the right direction. This is right mindfulness and is part of almost all of the aspects of the mind training. It has to start with that basic remembering of where to put your attention, where to keep a focus. So the seven factors of enlightenment paradigm structure starts with mindfulness, sati. And then right off the bat, the second one is dhammavicaya, or investigation of states, investigation of dhammas. So it starts with the investigative process. And I'll come back to that in just a minute, but then quickly, what follows in that sequence is virya, or energy, so that with investigation of dhammas, some investigation of certain themes, then a certain amount of energy, interest will develop, effort. One wants to put some effort into attending to some useful, wholesome themes for contemplation. And following on energy and interest will come a certain, if it's pursued and developed, a level of piti or joy, rapture at the investigation that one is engaged in. From then comes a sense of tranquility, moving into samadhi or concentration, and then ending as the seventh factor, the development of equanimity. So you can see in this sequence, rather than developing samadhi first and then moving on to reflection, investigation, and insight, it starts with investigation first, and that investigation serves as a basis for uplifting the mind and then settling the mind, concentrating the mind. And this is kind of an approach that I find often beneficial for myself. So Dhammavicaya, the investigation, one of the main factors that comes into play when reflecting on Dhamma themes is that factor of appropriate attention, where to put your attention. Using a skillful theme, it's not just a matter of thinking about anything. It's a way to develop wholesome states of mind that are supportive for the deepening level of ease and pleasure and concentration or settling, collectedness of the mind that we're moving towards, which then itself serves as a basis for developing deeper levels of insight. So what to put your attention on? And a lot of what I'm probably going to be saying this afternoon is absolutely repetitive of what Lungpa has already said the past couple of days. He's touched on many themes, and this morning even was talking about, and last night or yesterday afternoon sometime, about the different contemplations that we can use to develop a sense of uplift and joy in the mind, interest, enjoyment, pleasure. But we have to make sure that they're within the lines of the teachings, within the lines of Dhamma, not just kind of daydreaming about a, you know, pleasant worldly experience that we had or one that we want to have, but something that's more supportive of Dhamma investigation, Dhamma realization. So he was talking about some of the themes like development of faith, buddhanasati, and the teachings, the Dhamma, contemplation, reflection on the Sangha, those kinds of contemplations. And there's many others that we can use as Dhammavicaya, investigation. And I find those are really important in terms of just not only meditation retreats, but just daily life. And, you know, we can't all spend our lives just on the cushion. Somebody at tea time a couple of weeks ago at the monastery was saying, you know, and this was a very skillful practitioner, one who'd done a lot of practice and also was a teacher in her own right. And she was saying, well, you know, I'm here at the monastery staying for a couple of weeks, and I just notice how, even though you're not on retreat per se, there's just this incredible level of composure and ease that I don't see in my life. How do you do that? She says, that she has experienced that when she goes on retreats, but then it kind of tends to disappear in the hubbub of worldly life. And so we talked about that some, but a lot of it is just how we live our lives, what we put our minds onto, what we fill our space of attention with, and then the mind will adjust accordingly. What we attend to and think about becomes the inclination of our mind. And that's, you know, very important in our daily life. That's how we develop a composed continuity of practice, is by really working with what we put in through our sense bases and restraining that in some ways. But then also what it is that when we sit down to meditate or to practice and the mind is still racing with all of the things that we have had to attend to through the day, through our 8-hour workday or our 12 or 15-hour workday or whatever it is, how to kind of shift that attention, because the momentum is so strong from that kind of busyness. And so it's really good to have some quick reference points for what to attend to, what to think about, and how to use thought skillfully. You know, usually when we're caught up in the mental realm, the thinking realm, it's along the lines of what Lungpa was talking about the very first night, complication. The Pali word papancha is one of the translations, is complication. So we're caught in that whirlwind of perceptions and feelings that give rise to thinking and pondering, that give rise to proliferation, and that constantly reinforces that whole cycle. The more we proliferate, the more perceptions we experience and the attendant feelings and the more thinking we do about it, and it's a cycle that feeds on itself. And this is kind of the trap of unskillful ways of putting our attention into the thinking mental realm. But we can also use thinking in a skillful way to turn our minds back into a more easeful, wholesome direction. And it takes a bit of effort. It takes energy and focus, mindfulness as the core. So I'm working on that these first few days especially as well. You just have to kind of develop a set of tools or a set of reflections based on what's going on in your life and in interactions, experiences, to bring up skillful reflections. And I find that one of the contemplations that helps to settle my mind fairly quickly and fairly easily these days is trying to bring up some sort of sense of metta, loving-kindness reflection, something that turns the mind soft very quickly, and find that it's very useful to have a set of images or reflections, sometimes words, that help place the mind in that kind of easeful sense of gentleness, kindness, easeful well-being of metta, as a quick antidote to the busy, confused, engaged thinking mind. And I tend not to use the actual recitations and words that are often traditional and taught from the commentaries so much, because sometimes words are just more words. It still helps reinforce this chatty mind. But I tend to use more images and, images and feelings in the body, images that trigger certain feelings in the body of metta, warmth, kindness, easefulness. And if you're attentive, there's no shortage of those, because there's a lot of good people in the world and a lot of good things happening. And it just takes remembering them, recollecting them, and bringing them into the forefront of the mind. One of the images and experiences that I use these days is around my aging mother. She's back on the East Coast and has been going through a tough time. She's getting close to 92 and has been living on her own for several years now, but just ended up moving into an assisted living care facility just a few days ago, and has been physically failing. Her mental status is still pretty good, but she tends to get confused and doesn't remember things as well as she did before, and it's been falling a lot, and just kind of in a generally deteriorating state of health. And just was there maybe a month or so ago, visiting and helping make that decision that, you know, many of us find ourselves involved with aging parents, me and my sister, spending time with her and trying to help her come to the understanding that she just wasn't doing very well in her own place, even with some supports and help, that it just wasn't working out. And so that was a very, sensitive time. And my mom has never been an extremely gushy kind of person. She's always been a bit reserved. But my sister and I have always kind of tried to soften her up over the years, just by being attentive and kind and offering our support and care in the best way we could, in the ways that she would accept. And I think over the years she's kind of opened to that and softened to that, and had a very good time that week that I was there about a month ago. And we ended up needing to talk about some pretty difficult issues, things like end-of-life issues. What do you want to do if, there's a medical emergency, and do you want life-sustaining procedures and all the supports and keep you alive as long as possible, or do you want to do more things like let go naturally without a whole lot of invasive procedures and tests and life-saving procedures? And just trying to get a sense from her what kind of quality of life she wanted in her last years. And it, of course, opens up a lot of tender areas. So we did have those discussions. We pretty much got to everything except for the issues of what do you want at your funeral. We didn't quite get that far. Maybe for a future discussion. But we did get quite a lot of headway made. And it was a very real human discussion, and it's one that we hadn't had for a long, long, long time, that level of intimacy and truthfulness and honesty. And then, very uncharacteristic of her, as I was saying my goodbye on the last day that I was there, she was sitting on the couch and I was standing up, and she kind of just tugged at my robe, and she just kind of gave me this look of, like, don't go, which was so sweet. And that's the last image I had of that visit with her. And then actually had a phone call with her yesterday after she'd been in her new place for a few days, and she was talking about how she was so good to hear my voice and would, you know, really missed me and would like me to come out and visit. And I told her, I said, well, you know, if you really need me to come out, I'm always available to do that. And she said, well, I don't need you, but I want you to come out. So just these moments, you know, just kind of like real tender moments that can occur in human life. And those are the kind of, that's what I use. I use that image, that memory, that thought, remembering that tug on the robe and that look on her face, or that kind of very tender expression of fondness over the phone yesterday. And it doesn't take long to just completely short-circuit any of the proliferations or memories from the crazy neighbors or the the legal issues or the personality conflicts or whatever it is that's going on. And that's a metta practice. You know, you don't have to be reciting lines of, you know, may I be well, may they be well, you don't have to do that. Just bringing up a reflection or a memory that opens up a sense of tenderness, of kindness, of gentleness, of well-wishing. And then to not keep it at a personal level, you know, it's not just between me and my mother, but to take that feeling, really develop that inside, dwell with that, sink into it, absorb into it, nourish it, and expand it, globalize it, generalize it beyond just one or two people. And just use those images, use those memories as a trigger to move into a more expansive, settled, peaceful, gentle space. Yeah, and as Lung Pa was saying the other day, or this morning, I can't remember which, just it's so important to just find your own way. You don't have to be following a formula, but to know what a skillful mind state is, to know what it is that we're moving towards in terms of an experience, in terms of a feeling, and to explore and try things out, try your own ways of developing that sense of ease of mind, that sense of peace of mind, because we're all going to have different ways that we can do that, different kinds of investigation. And maybe for some lucky people, you can just focus right on the breathing, the feeling of the body, and that's a strong trigger point for you. But if not, there's many other ways of using the act of investigation to do that. One of the other contemplations that I find extremely useful in terms of dropping stuff is some of the contemplations on the three characteristics. You don't have to wait until the mind is in a very deep state of samadhi to contemplate anicca, dukkha, anatta. They're contemplations that in and of themselves, even right from the start, are very useful ways to investigate, to just start to incline the mind in that direction. Even if it's not a deep penetration, it's a very skillful way of reflecting on the world and our experience. The mind habit of the experience of self is, as we all know, at the root of so much of our suffering. And developing little bits of insight into the characteristic of not-self can go a long way, at least in my practice, towards relief from obsessions, relief from that kind of suffering, that dukkha that we can all experience when we're so wrapped up in our personal experience, the sense that this is all happening to me, that this is all mine, and this is what I am all about. Because that core experience of dukkha is really strongly related to how we personally identify with these experiences. So the craziness of the world around us, things that are happening, things that we have to deal with, much of that is not avoidable. How we relate to it is a little bit more controllable. We have an opportunity to respond in a way that doesn't draw us into identification with what is happening to us. As Lungpa was saying, we can experience it more on a phenomenological level. We can see it as experience that is happening, that we are involved with, but that we don't need to hold to closely as who we are. One of the ways that the sense of self manifests is in the perception of mine. This is mine. This is me. So that we think of this body as mine, you know, that there's somehow some being that possesses this body. That's how we operate. Even if we don't think about that in a very conscious way or very deliberate way, we operate as if that's the case. This body is mine, or these feelings are mine, these perceptions are mine. I own them. And these thoughts and emotions, this consciousness, they're all me or mine. And we know from the teachings that this really is just a perception. The perception of me, mine, is just another perception. It doesn't have inherent reality to it. So we think about that sometimes, and I think maybe it can be a little confusing because it's so real and it's so solid. And if there is, and if, you know, the body is not self and these feelings are not self, these perceptions and thoughts, if they're not self, then why do I feel like they are? What gives rise to that perception? What's the root cause of that? If it's really not anything inherently substantial and, you know, an ultimate truth, then why do I experience it like that? And as many teachers, and I think I just last heard it in a talk from Ajahn Suchito, that it's really the mental factor, the mental quality of clinging that leads to that sense of me and mine. So even though there's no inherent mine or me holding to these experiences of body and mind, there is this process of clinging. And that's what we have to see if we really want to penetrate and let go of the very imprisoning experience of self-identification with these factors. So I sometimes find that's a very useful contemplation too, when I'm wrapped up in me or mine, these problems, these issues, these things that I have been, you know, enjoined to resolve, to solve, to deal with, to attend to, and it's all feeling very burdensome and close and difficult and keeps on playing around in my consciousness. Sometimes a very useful way to help short-circuit that is to really investigate the feeling of clinging. So to go in a quiet moment, to allow the mind to experience the dukkha of that clinging, to really allow oneself to move into that and not to push it away. You know, the tendency is to want to say, okay, I'm meditating now, so I'll go to my breath and I'll relax and then I won't have to feel this, I won't have to experience this. But that adds just another layer of aversion to the whole process, and for me that doesn't usually work very well. So a willingness to follow the difficulty, follow the dukkha to its core, and to see that it's based on holding on to something, you know, holding on to some sort of thought or memory or interaction or opinion or some sort of view that if I can just find a solution, then everything will go away. But following it on a real feeling level, letting go of the words, which are just sort of surface manifestations of this inner wanting to not experience something that's difficult, not really wanting to touch the dukkha, and really taking the leap and being kind of brave to go in and follow dukkha to its core, to see what it is that I might be holding on to. And that's a real bodily experience. It can't be done with the thinking mind very easily, only using thinking as a way of directing the mind, just to be able to say, use the thoughts to say something like, you know, okay, got to go to the body, got to go to the actual experience, feel it inside the body, feel the tension, the stress, the holding. Where's the holding? Where's the clinging? And then to allow the mind to open up to that, to move right to that experience. And if that can be seen and just touched, acknowledged, and then with a conscious intention to release, to let go, to not cling, realizing that the suffering, the dukkha, the tension, the stress, that's all caused by holding on to it as mine, something that I need to do something about to get rid of. But just moving simply to really touching it and then letting it go. Again, as Lungpa said earlier, quoting Ajahn Chah, you know, basically the practice can be summed up in those three words, know, or four words, know and let go. So really moving into that experience, allowing that to happen, and then to release. So this is touching the experience of one of the ways that this self-perception manifests in this me and mine that really is not inherently there, but is the result of this kind of clinging to either the body or the various aspects of the mind as who we are. And when it's unpleasant, it's something that we feel like we have to change, we have to do something about. But just moving back towards what it is that I'm holding on to, how is it that I'm holding, what does that feel like? Can there be letting go? Can there be release? And if you do that, even just a little bit, you can see the space, the openness that happens in the heart, opens in the mind. There's a truthfulness to that. There's an integrity of acknowledging the truth, asking yourself, what is really the truth here? What is really the truth? The truth is that I don't like this. I don't want it. I wish it weren't here. And that's the way it is, you know. The truth is also, it's here. This is what it is. But just touching that truth with honesty is often enough to allow an opening, allow a release. And then you have to let that happen too. You have to acknowledge that release, allow it to manifest. And if you do that, whether that kind of openness of the mind comes from that kind of investigation or whether it comes from more of the planting in of a nice soft image, like of loving kindness, the mother tugging on your robe, you can see just how that kind of approach, at least I find that, oftentimes is so much more accessible than trying to force my mind onto the in and out breath to get a sense of peace of mind. And what I find often happens is that when I go through an investigative process, like I was just describing, that the mind settles and then it naturally wants to go to the breathing. All of a sudden the breathing is there. It wasn't so obvious before, but once the mind has relinquished some difficulty or has softened in some way or opened in some way, then the breath manifests because the mind doesn't get so hooked up and wrapped up in all of its various machinations. And the attention wants to go to something more subtle and pleasing and, for me, bodily oriented. And the breathing, all of a sudden, it's of course it's always there, but all of a sudden it's really there in full consciousness. Ajahn Suchito again had I was listening to some of his talks a while back, and had a very nice way of saying it, that so oftentimes we spend a lot of energy and time looking for the breath, but if we can do some of these preparatory investigations to settle the mind, to soften the mind, to open the mind, then it's more like letting the breath come and find us, and it will. So if you have these kinds of investigations that you can develop over time, practice, putting more of these things into your toolkit for contemplation, then you pull them out when you need to, and you can see how they can lead to that sense of interest, that sense of uplift, pleasure, tranquility, and then the mind will settle based on this, how we pay attention, what we think about, ponder about frequently, letting that become the inclination of the mind and a way of helping it to settle. And not to be afraid to use those over and over again. The more you use them, the more quickly they have their effect, because that is becoming the nature of your mind, the inclination of your mind, is picking up on these themes that lead to peace, tranquility, contentedness. So those are just a few thoughts of a person who's in the third day of retreat, like everybody else, and just leave that, offer that for your reflection this afternoon.